Daniel and three of his friends had been taken from Israel because of their talents and good looks to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's court. They had to spend quite a long time preparing for that, learning the language, learning the etiquette of standing before the king, learning to control yourself and to stand for hours at a time, even if you have to go to the bathroom or anything else, that you don't move until the king calls upon you to for a word of wisdom or something like that. And they would spend 3 years preparing for this. And Daniel and his three friends were chosen to be amongst those who would get the pleasure of the personal attention of the king. And they would stand around him. Now, part of that preparation involved getting the finest foods. They would be groomed with the best meats and the best diet, so they could be as healthy as you could possibly think. Of course, that does not sit well with Daniel. Daniel does not want to eat the meat of the king. And he begged this man responsible for the diet, for the nutrition, if he could beg off of the meat. And the man said, if you appear before the king not looking like you're in perfect shape, he'll kill me. Imagine how you have to walk on eggshells before the king at any moment. So I fear if I present you before the king and you're not in the best of health. So Daniel, this is where we left off. Daniel said, let us try for 10 days. Feed us only fruits and vegetables and herbs for 10 days. And we won't eat the meat like everybody else. We'll just eat grains, herbs, vegetables, fruits, and we'll satisfy ourselves on that. Right? The food may not be as tasty as what everyone else is eating. But if you're talking about health, now it's interesting, today we know that this is a much healthier diet than to constantly eat the meat of the king. So this is where we left off. Let's read it inside. Okay. They asked for the 10-day grace period to see if they lose any health. Vayishma lahem ladavar hazeh. Vayinasem yamim asara. And he heard them on this. He heard means he accepted. He heeded this matter. Right? Vayinasem yamim asara. And he tested them for 10 days. I mentioned last week that Nehemiah also made such a deal, only he takes credit and he says, remember me for good, O God, that I was the only one who made this deal not to eat the king's food. Right? You're not. Daniel also made such a deal, and Esther also. It says, Vayishaneha ve'esmanoseha. When Esther was brought before Ahasuerus, they also had a period where they had to groom the women to see the king, right? And I assure you, they also gave them the finest foods. Only Esther asked, again, for a special diet. So Nehemiah praises himself and pats himself on the back at the expense of other Jews. He says, I'm the only one who behaves this way in the court of the king. That is the reason why, if you recall, he doesn't get his own book. Well, you'll see at the top of some pages here, Nehemiah, right, Nehemiah. But the book is really Ezra Nehemiah. There is no book called Nehemiah in the Bible. Right? There are 24 books in the Bible. That's Ezra is one book. Ezra Nehemiah is one book. If you look in the table of contents in the beginning of the Tanakh, I'm sure you will say Ezra Nehemiah is one book. Ezra Nehemiah. So Ezra Nehemiah is Sefer Ezra. Whatever Nehemiah writes, in fact, in the Gemara, when it quotes a passage from Nehemiah, it says, what did Ezra mean when he said this? Okay. Mm. Alright, so we see from our book that Daniel also asked for a special diet. Okay. And he received it. And the test was, let's see if it was successful. Umiktsas yomim, pasuk tezvav. Everyone hear it? Umiktsas yomim asara nirav marehem tov ubriye basar. After 10 days, their appearance was just as healthy as anyone else. Min kol yildim aluchnim es paspag hamelech, even healthier than all those who were eating the fatty meat of the king. All those who are eating the food that belongs to the king.
I'm so
according to this week, you know, we can explain this. We can explain this hashkafically. Hashem can have them eat mud pies and make them healthier than everyone else. That's hashkafically explained. But we can explain this even scientifically. That the diet they were asking for has been proven to be much healthier. Grains, vegetables, fruits, and herbs are much healthier than a constant overflow of meat. Okay? I mean, look, you have Sforno. I don't know if I said this last week. Sforno tries to explain why were they were all of a sudden were allowed to eat meat after the flood story. Right? So, the flood involved people's violence one to another. So now that God saw how violent man can be to other men, he said, okay, take your violence out on animals. Chef the animals if you're so violent. Another interpretation is that animals owed their existence to man because of the flood. If Noah had not taken all those animals on the ark, they all would have drowned in the flood. So now that we saved the animals, we have the right to eat them. I don't know if you'd use that example on people, but that's the second interpretation. Another interpretation I found in the Chizkuni relates to this, but it's a little different. The Chizkuni says, and this is so this Sforno. Sforno says that until the flood, all the vegetables and fruits and herbs and grains were from the original creation. They were seeds from what God created. And what God created had such a manifest health benefit that people lived very long. If you eat from an apple tree that God created, not the tree of knowledge, but if you eat from an apple tree that God created, it's going to let you live a very long, long life. But after the flood, people started living very much shorter because all that was destroyed. Now what man is eating comes from what man planted. So now that we don't have that blessing of good health, God said, okay, get the protein from meat. Now you can eat meat because you lost the good health of eating with what I planted. So it's very different than this. Yeah, that Sforno was saying that meat... But we know today that some meat serves replenish certain losses that our body may make, and that certain meats, so, you know, in moderation, of course. But to eat too much meat is why they say Kohanim are hot-headed. You ever hear of that? Kohanim always have a hot head because their main staple. Their food is of all the kavanos, all the sacrifices that they're getting from their work in the temple. Right. So, Talmud says that if you're born when Mars passes over Earth's orbit, you'll have a violent streak. There's mazel of in mazel Yisrael. You can undo it through your exercising your free will. Someone says, I was born under Mars in the summertime, but I'm not violent. Because yes, you are. You're a shochet. Another person's a moel. Another person's a surgeon. And, you know, you're doing different things to channel it. Okay. So here they ate the grains and were just as healthy as anyone else. Vayihi ha-meltzar. Meltzar is a modern word. You know what it means in Hebrew today?
A waiter.
A waiter.
A waiter. So this meltzar doesn't appear to be a Hebrew word in its origins. Meltzar noseas paspagam v'yein mishteyen. The waiter brought in their menu and their food, and yein mishteyen, and the wine that they were supposed to drink. V'nosein lahem zer onim. He didn't serve them the wine. He didn't serve them the meat. Instead, he fed them zer onim.
Seeds?
Which means seeds, yeah.
What is pulse? I never heard that word. Instead of wine, he gave
pulse.
Pulse
is like alfalfa, sprouts. Right. Notice that they're avoiding not only the meat of the king, but also the wine of the king.
Yeah.
And wine is ostensibly grains and fruits and vegetables, right? But even from this early time, it appears that wine is something that is to be avoided, like we know very well now, the wine that Gentiles drink, because they tend to make libations out of it. Right? So there is a famous medrash that Haman got Ahasuerus to be angry with Mordechai by saying to the king You know, test Mordechai. If a fly would fall in his wine, he'll pick up the fly, throw it out, and drink the wine. Which is halacha. You may not want to, but you can. But if you, my king, would even touch the outside of the wine with your hand, he won't drink it. He goes, what? Why would anyone do such a thing? Just because he hates you. So he tried it at Mordechai, and Mordechai refused to drink the wine. So Ahasuerus, you know, he gets angry very easily. So Mordechai said, he tried to explain himself why he had nothing to do with you as a king or anything like that. Adrava, he says, I see that you have a little dish where you rinse your fingers after you eat your food, and you keep rinsing your fingers in the dish. I'll drink that, just to show you, because it's not wine. Right? So he drank his finger water. So he says that they stayed away from the wine and the food, but they ate zeronim, from the word zera, which means seeds. God gave them the power in order to understand and perceive of all of the mada. Mada is the modern word for science. This is the only context with which the word appears in Tanakh, except for one reference in Divrei Hayamim describing Shlomo HaMelech's knowledge. Steeped in mada.
You were told where mada comes from?
Vahaskel, the word for seichel. Seichel is often used to determine common sense. Right? Where's your seichel? Mm-hmm. No one says, where's your das? Where's your chokhmah? They say, where's your seichel? Come on.
The one thing in the world that's not common.
So there are many different words, especially in Sefer Mishlei, for knowledge. This chokhmah, deya, bina, haskel.
Bina is intuition.
Right, the province of women, they say, because when man, God created woman, it says by Yiven. More than it's a binyan, it's a bina. As opposed to man, who's more interested in just, you know, how things work and the moment, not planning so far ahead. Right, so that's more in the realm of chokhmah. Okay, so bina is a higher cognitive level of thinking than das. Knowledge. Okay. Knowledge is the foundation of being, of comprehension.
It's just like the name in the
language. Right. Bain, right? With Bain. Okay. So all of them had all of these elements of understanding and common sense and book smarts. That's called Sefer V'Chochma. You know, you can be book smart too. Sometimes people are book smart, and it ends right there. As some people say, stupid is as stupid does. You're only as smart as the things we do. Right? There's some very smart people who do stupid things, even though they may think it's smart. You know? Anyway, it says, "V'Daniel hevin b'chol chazon v'chalamos," but Daniel was above them. Daniel was steeped in chazon v'chalamos. He had clairvoyance. He could interpret dreams. Now, the Babylonians, everybody knows, was at that time the world's experts on these issues. They loved wisdom, that's to be sure. But they also were steeped in magic and incantations and curses and spells and other things of that sort. There's a grand dispute in our commentaries whether these things actually exist, or whether they are by definition a sleight of hand. Did Houdini have, with all his great magic tricks, it wasn't a sleight of hand. It wasn't magic. He had certain abilities. He was able to regurgitate things from his neck or his throat. He would swallow a key and then bring it back up in the jail and then quickly undo himself. He was very, very, he could maneuver his hands up and down. So it's not magic. He taught himself how to do these things. Right? Time, and if that's your business, you know, you do it well, so good. But there are some Mepharshim that say, no, that God has sometimes in history actually given black magic to people. Mm-hmm. That the Egyptians were actually able to create those frogs, to bring the frogs out of the water, or to You know, now they even have these things you could put in water, and then all of a sudden it becomes like a big frog. It's not alive, but it looks, you know. So they were able to make water turn to blood, or blood turn to water. They you know, they also matched Moshe a few times, right? So Rashi, for instance, says that the Egyptians had such a power. The Rambam, Maimonides, is more rational, said no, they just had a very, very good and a sleight of hand. Right? As miraculous as it may seem, it was all just being very good at it. Right? Or the woman who raised Shmuel from the dead. The Rambam says, no, it's only it's bogus, there was someone under the table, it wasn't real. Rashi says, no, God gave the power to some people to do it. That's why they have the death penalty for doing it. The Rambam says, even though it's not really being done, if I'm going to say, the Torah says, if someone calls back another person from the dead, that person is guilty of the death penalty. I don't want people to do that. So why would you give the person a death penalty if they didn't really do it? They're just making believe they're doing it. Well, it doesn't matter whether they're actually doing it or not. It fools people into thinking that the dead have control or sway over us. So I saw in the parish of Shmuel Bar Chofni an interesting, it's a compromise between the two. Shmuel was raised from the dead that day. You know what I'm talking about, the story at the end of Shmuel Aleph. Shmuel was raised from the dead that day. Only who did it? Hashem did it. God did it for her. That's why. What did she see when she saw him? She started screaming. She was surprised. And she said, "Whoa! This never happened before. This is the first time I've ever seen this happen." Well, for the other time, I know it's bogus. It's a fake. But this time, it really happened. So she was so surprised. Rabbah says what it was is that Shaul himself spoke out those words. She hypnotized him into thinking what Shmuel was saying. He spoke those words. Demonstrate his greatest fears of what was about to happen. Okay, so in Babylonia, they were steeped in this kind of behavior. Everyone's calling back from the dead. Everyone's having a seance. They're very superstitious. Everything is a sign, an omen, right? And Daniel, we'll see in a minute, can compete with the best of them. Okay. And the time came before the king said to bring them in. Now, you know you had to have, how long you had to prepare to see the king?
3 years.
3 years. You imagine? This is how you go to college, just in order to be able to stand before the king. With the proper etiquette. Make sure that this is what you do. Don't do it. Don't go off base. Don't go off kilter. Don't read off the teleprompter. Everything is exactly as it should be. Huh? Right. Can you read your test?
ידבר יצאם המלך ולא נמצא מכולם כדניאל, חנניה, מישאל ועזריה ויעמדו לפני המלך.
Okay. And the king started to speak to them. And he found that there was no one in the kingdom like these four. As often happens, the Jew rises to the top. Okay. Notice it says after speaking to them he learned this. Not necessarily just by looking at them. They may have been better looking men that were brought in, right? So by speaking to them, he determined that there are none like these four. Okay, there are all kinds of studies that wonder what can explain the Jewish propensity to succeed, and the answer is that we're geared to success because of the observance of Torah. Gears one to success, but that's not enough. There are many Jews who don't keep Torah and still manage to win the Nobel Prizes and find cures for polio and the like.
Because their mothers pushed them.
Right, so there's something in the DNA that just the way we are. And I, you know, whenever this comes up, I look at my kids. My kids don't know one friend who didn't graduate college. There's some places in this country where 2% of the population finishes college. But a friend of theirs where they don't finish college? One of our children almost didn't finish college. She was married at 19 and she almost was thinking of not finishing college. Oh, no. We hit her over the head. Her mother said, "Don't you even think of it. She's going to Israel. Don't you even think that you're finishing college."
Of course.
Right? Never mind high school. There are places in the country where 30% don't finish high school. Right.
Are there any Jews among them?
Not, I'm just saying, though, that sometimes there are very, very secular Jews who go, you know, the way of the rest of society. But I'm just saying, but there's, I once heard a sort of, it's like an, almost an anthropological explanation, is that the reading of the Hebrew language is very complicated. Because there are vowels and the consonants to read at the same time. Now, that vowel system is actually the ones that we know with the three dots as an A and one dot. That's not so old. It's only not much more than 1,000 years old. It used to be at the top of the letters, and then about 1,000 years ago it was put to the bottom of the letters.
And the prayer books were all written without...
Prayer books, there's no prayer book more than 1,000 years old. Oh. People prayed by heart. So you had the chazan praying for everybody. For the vast majority of people who didn't know what to say.
Yes,
but Tanakh, you didn't open up a Torah. There's no dots in the Torah. Right? So you had to be very proficient in reading the word Bereshis. Maybe it's Berocious, maybe it's Berushis, maybe it could be 20 different things. So you had to be so steeped in just reading the language, because there are no vowels in the language. Right? So you had to really concentrate. So that concentration in itself, when you're 2-3 years old, now even more so, because you have to do two things at the same time. You have to know that this letter has a Z sound, and also it's not Z, Zu, Z, Zu. You have to put it together with the sign underneath. And that's using two sides of the brain at the same time, at 3 years old. At 3-4 years old. So we're already geared at such a young age, if only that we'd be challenged properly. We have to continue to be challenged properly. Okay, so here are Daniel and his three Jewish friends. Now, as we know Jewish history, what's about to happen?
The three friends. Oh, Shadrach, Meshach, Arachah.
I understand. But what in Jewish history is going to happen as a direct result of these four Jews rising to the top of everybody else in their midst?
Jealousy.
Say that again?
Jealousy.
Oh, jealousy.
And it's the first time isn't in Egypt either. The first time is in Philistia, where Yitzchak goes to live amongst the Plishtim.
So well.
He succeeds. And they say, Leich me'imanu, ki atzamtam imenu me'od. First clear sign of, we call it anti-Semitism, what are we calling it? The first clear sign of, get out of my midst, the you Jew, because we can't stand to watch your success. So this past Shabbos, I spoke about the sibling rivalry, about how you see in Bereishis, the younger child succeeds over the older child, and the older child doesn't take kindly to that so much. The kind kills his brother. You see, an older child can live with the success of the younger child if that success helps me. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm sure you've read a novel or two about a family with 9 boys, and the oldest 8 all work on the docks, and the oldest 8 all have to leave high school to help to make a living for this large family, and the youngest boy gets to go to college, and he goes to law school, and they are so proud of him, right? You think they want to? Would they want to kill him? No, because they look at his success is helping them, maybe.
Success.
But with Yosef worked.
Doing it.
But Yosef, yes, yeah. And had a share in it. But Yosef used his favoritism and spoke against them, gave bad reports about them, bragged about his status. It's not very mature, right? So I have a whole different approach to it wasn't that he was immature. If you look very carefully at everything he was saying, his mother was missing also, but he wanted to be helpful. He wanted to be liked. And when it says, Vayavedi basam ra'oi, it says, V'hu nar has been a... His father gave him a long-sleeved coat. I know this is a digression, but it's directly related to what we're about to read. You'll see. With Yosef's life and Daniel's life. Is that his father gave him a long-sleeved coat because he didn't have to work. He got to study, and the brothers had short-sleeved shirts. You have to work in the field. You can wear short-sleeved shirts. You don't have to get ripped in the field. So his pasim means exonus that goes to your pas. Pas is a wrist. That's the real pshat of Ksonis Pas. Long sleeve. Pas can also mean a stripe, so it could be that. But in this pshat, because what difference does it make striped or not? A pas is a wrist, a shirt that went all the way down to the wrist. It was like a coat, a jacket. You sit inside, you're wearing a jacket. Outside, you got to wear it to take off because it's too hot to work. Mm-hmm. So Yosef got to learn everything from his father, who apparently, from Parshas Vayetze, was quite the knowledgeable shepherd. So when it says Yosef... Nahar has been. He was trying to tell his older brothers the secrets my father taught me about shepherding. No, I want to be helpful to you. But the older brothers don't want a pitcher like him to tell them how to do things. Who are you? So he would bring the bad reports that they're lazy, they're not doing the best work they can do in the fields. They could, if they only did this way, like I know, that they'd be better at shepherding. I know this is not the typical parish of Rashi that you're familiar with, but Yosef was immature in that he thought that why wouldn't they want to listen to me? I have so many good things to share with them. I want to be helpful to them. Why don't they want me to be helpful? Right. Anyway. So what I said at the end of the presentation was that, about sibling rivalry, was that it's a lesson for the Jews in general, is that it's crucial. And I hope that this community feels it. I know that they feel this shul won 3 awards in the last 10 years about West Side's leadership. And it's for not just Jewish organizations, but for religious organizations. Anyway, that the community has to feel that we're better because the Jews are here. I don't know if they'll always feel it. The anti-Semite, nothing will help the anti-Semite. Yeah. Right? But that in general, that they feel that you know, they'll be jealous if you have to leave work at 2 o'clock every Friday for the next 4 months. They're going to be jealous of that. So what do you do to make it better for them? Fill in for them on December 25th. Fill in for them on Thanksgiving. Fill in for them on January 1st. On days where, you know, you'd maybe like to take off, but you take off on your holidays, so fill in for them on their holidays. Right, so Daniel didn't bring any of this anti-Semitism upon himself. There's nothing he can do. He's just the favorite of the king. Adarabba, he's about to save his whole membership in the next story, and still they hate him. So sometimes you can say there's nothing we can do. Right, just have to maintain our equilibrium. So they all stood before the king. V'chol dvar chokhmas bina asher bikesh mehem amelech. You see what these guys were? They're Google. Anything the king wanted to know at any moment, just call out to them, and they're going to know it. Not only do they not have to go to a book to get it, they'll know it on the spot. Right? And they were found to be 10 times better than all the other Chartumim, Ashafim, astrologers, probably have soothsayers, maybe necromancers. Right? Helen, how does it translate those words? Chartumim and Ashafim.
Necromancers?
Yeah.
Astrologers.
Necromancer comes from the word, the Latin word for dead, death. Necromancer is someone who calls the dead
back to life.
Call them for advice. Called in Hebrew Balat Ov. Okay. So they were well beyond all those other people who trained and lived in these things. Daniel, of course, knows his Torah that says you're not supposed to do those things. Vahi Daniel ad shnas achas lekoreh shamelech. Now, this is obviously an editor's note. This is placed in the book well after this, because from the time of Nebuchadnezzar to the first year of Cyrus,
it's a long time.
It is quite a long time. His son ruled after him, Evel-Merodach. Right? Evel-Merodach's son ruled after him, Belshazzar. He's the guy with the handwriting on the wall. The Persian king, the Median king who conquered him was Dariavesh. Right? That'll be chapter 5 of this book. We'll keep it there, but there's still a few more kings. The king after that, Dariavesh, was Koresh. So that happens sometimes in the book. It'll tell you now, like it says in Shmos, a very famous place in Shmos, it says when the mon started to fall, it says, and the mon fell for 40 years in the desert until the Israelites came to their land. Whoa! 40 years? I don't know in Shmos that was supposed to be 40 years in the desert. I don't find that out until the Midbar. Right? but that's, you know, okay. But someone reading that is going to say, what? What, 40 years? I mean, I assume if you haven't read anything after this yet. What, 40 years? They're supposed to go 11 days' journey into Israel, huh? Okay, that's what this passage is. There are psukim like this in many places in the Bible. For instance, I'll give one last example. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tes. When Shaul is looking for his donkeys, remember that story? And he said, where is the Ro'eh in this town? So, there's like an editor's note that says, today we call a prophet a Navi. In those days, they called a prophet a Ro'eh. That's why when Shaul was looking for his donkeys, he said, where is the Ro'eh? It's clearly an editor's note. Because it's just saying, what we call today a Navi, in those days, they called a Ro'eh. Right, so
that.
Here? Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, Vishnah Shtayim L'Malchus Nebuchadnezzar, Cholam Nebuchadnezzar Chalamot. Chalamot, not one dream, but dreams. This is a compendium of a number of dreams. Okay. Now, it says, Vatit pa'em rucho, ushnato nihiyata alav. In fact, these are the exact words that's used by Paro.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. There it says, however, Vatipa em rucho. Here it's Vatitpa em rucho.
What's the difference?
Grammar, just the Hebrew, just. It's the shorish is pei ayin mem. Mm-hmm. Here it is an extra letter. It says Vatispa em rucho. And in. When Paro wakes up and is bothered by his dream, it says Vatipa em rucho. Any possibilities? There is no pshat to this. Only pshat you can say is that the word evolved so that words like this would have an extra tough in it. Okay? Rashi, however, gives a drash. What did Paro want to know? What the dreams meant. Right?
He wanted to know what the dream was.
Nebuchadnezzar didn't remember the dreams. So, says Ushnatoni Talav, he couldn't sleep. He knew he was bothered by something. Does that ever happen to you?
In your moment.
Yeah, you have.
You wake up and you know it was a bad dream, but you can't remember.
But you can't remember anything about it.
Yeah.
Not even one thing about it. Sometimes you remember right away, and then a few minutes later,
you
forget.
But you don't know the detail.
Yeah. But you know it bothers you. Right. Here he's calling all of them in. Chartumim, the necromancers, Ashafim, the astrologers, Chashfim, the sorcerers, the magicians. Kastim says the Chaldeans. Chaldeans are the people who. Astrologers. Lahagid l'melech chalamotav. Tell the king what his dream is about. Now, at this point, it's to tell the king probably what it means, the interpretation of the dream at this point. You know, and the reader doesn't really know to what extent Nebuchadnezzar is going to tell them what they need to do. They stood, they came, and they stood before the king. Which is the word Ashafim. Hebrew Ashaf is the PLO. Irgun Shechur Falastani. I say, because when we got married, someone gave us. You ever see those glasses? They have initials on them.
Javon, glass factory.
So they got a big Aleph Shin Pei. An Israeli once came to our house and said, what are you doing? It's like PLO on an Hebrew. Because we didn't realize it
we
at
didn't
the
even
time.
Know.
It's Eliezer Fredel, the Schwartz. It looks like Asham. So Ashafim is indeed a Hebrew word. It means the astrologers.
The necromancers.
Yeah, I don't know why they need necromancers.
I don't like that word because I don't understand it.
Necro is
it dead?
Dead. No, people who call back the dead. Now, the fact is that the word does appear in the Torah. Remember when Paro's, to make Paro? Let's see what if they use the same English translation here. Right. So Moshe puts the stick before Paro. Right. They ask King Chartumei Mitzrayim. Oh, the necromancers of Egypt. How do you like that? Okay. I would have thought some other. Just usually it's translated magicians. Okay, weiter.
It sounds very learned, necromancer. Magician, anybody can be a magician.
Vayidabru ha-kasdim la-melech Aramis. So the kasdim were from Aram. Atah Hashem Elokim Asher Bachartu Avram Vehotzeiso Meur Kasdim V'samto Shmo Avraham U'Matzasas V'Kon Melchanech. Avram is from the place where the Aram Naharayim, where they speak Aramaic. So guess what? Look what happens. The next four chapters are in Aramaic.
Oh my goodness,
because it tells us the original language they spoke. Now it's a little difficult to understand. Why does this book do this? They're speaking Aramaic, right? Good Shabbos. Do you think that Shmos was spoken in Hebrew?
What was the question?
Do you think that when Paro told Moshe...
Oh, right, that wasn't his native language.
Why would Paro start to speak in Hebrew? You know what I'm saying? This Bible is written in many languages. Do you think that I don't know, Bilam maybe have spoken Moabite, maybe, I don't know, but there are all sections. You think that when Lavan and Yaakov conferred in Aram, that Yaakov forced Lavan and his whole family to start speaking Hebrew? He's speaking Aramaic up there. That's how the Torah was translated. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the famous example is Ibn Ezra, and then later the Das Kanan, about the name of Moshe. Moshe's name couldn't be Moshe. Because to draw from water doesn't sound like Moshe in Egyptian. Right? Remember Ibn Ezra says it's Manas. That's the kind of famous name, Moshe Manas. The drawer from water in ancient Egyptian is not Moshe, it's in Hebrew. You mean Paro's daughter sized up the moment and said, oh, this boy is going to speak. He didn't know he was yet. I don't know, maybe she did. She said, Miyadeh Evrimi, said afterwards. No, but by that time she knew it was Hebrew, actually.
Yeah,
so what did they speak among? The Jews speak among them each other. Among
so a Jew speaks to a Jew, they speak in Hebrew, fine. But the Egyptians are talking here, Philistines are talking. Stama, in the original, we have to have subtitles. This book was written for Jews, so it's written in Hebrew. But much of it is a translation of what was originally spoken. And through prophecy, we're told what should be written down.
So the question is, why don't they translate this?
So why not just translate this into Hebrew? So the answer is because the Jews reading it at this time were more steeped in Aramaic than Hebrew. Same reason that the Talmud is in Aramaic is why these books stayed in Aramaic. Why translate it in Hebrew when the mother tongue of the people at this time likely to read this is Aramaic?
So why are they
like ours is English.
Why did they translate Esther?
The answer I would give to that is Aramaic is at least somewhat close to Hebrew. And Persian is...
different language.
It's so different. It's Persian is not even Semitic. Aramaic is at least Semitic.
Is it anything like Farsi, or is that another word for it?
I think the Farsi language
is
today
a dialect
of Persian. But the Farsi today is much more influenced by Arabic, which is also Semitic. Yeah. Arabic is very, very close to Hebrew. We may not be able to
a lot of root words are all the same in all the languages.
But when you move from Semitic languages to Yefet languages, Persia is Yefet, or certainly Hamite languages, the roots get very different. Okay, anyway, let's just make our way through. I mean, we can just read the English straight, but you know, but this is good exercise in King, live forever. But you see, it's so close to Hebrew. Malka, melech, la'olmin, la'olam, chayi, live. O king, live forever. Emar chelma la'avdach. Tell the dream to your servants. Upishra nechaveh. Pishra, so far, every word is almost Hebrew. Pesher means to. Yeah, we'll give the interpretation. We will give. Onei malka va'amar l'kastoi. King answered to his Chaldeans, to his astrologers. Milsa mini azda, hein lo sahodu ununai chelma. The thing has been lost from me. Milsa means the thing from me is gone. Right? If you do not tell me the dream and its interpretation, hadamin titavdun uvatich uvatechen nivali yit samun. If you do not tell me the dream and its interpretation, then I will destroy you and your houses. Okay? Your house will be made into a heap. V'hein chelma upishre tachavon. But if you do tell me the dream and its interpretation, matnon v'niv univizba Vikor sagi tekablon min kadamai. Lohen chelma upishre achavoni. But if you do tell me the dream and the interpretation of it, I will give you matnon, gifts, right? An honor, yikor. Nivizba is a strange word. It means like.
Like an award.
Yeah. Like pizza. Okay. Tekablon min, you will receive from me. Lohen chelma upishre achavoni. Just tell me the dream and its interpretation, and I'll bestow upon you great reward. Now,
it's interesting, though, that the king would assume they can divine a dream that he has forgotten.
That he has what?
He can't tell them what he dreamt.
He cannot remember the
Well,
dream.
The Gemara says that
that's what
he warned them, that he warned them, don't come up with something. I'll know what it's not. Don't just dream up something on your own. I'll know if you did that. When you tell me what the dream was and you're right, I'll remember it. Now this is crucial because I'm going to conclude shortly and give you something to look forward to next week. The interpretation of this dream is not a good one for him.
For the king.
For the king. It'll not be good. So, of course, people are going to be afraid if they know the true interpretation of it to tell it to the king. Like every yes man kisses up to a. They said that Saddam Hussein, when he wanted to go into Kuwait, had a certain approach to this, and one of his top generals thought that he should just wait it out and. Something that Hussein wasn't. They were about to have a lunch meal. That top general, I mean, he was like top, like a defense secretary. Mm-hmm. His head was under one of the
platters.
They took with meat and dishes, and one of the platters had the man's head. Just to show what happens when you try to tell
he
me.
Opposed the king.
Right? Mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar was actually the king of the same country. It's Iraq. Saddam Hussein claimed to have been the descendant of a Nebuchadnezzar, like some kind of.
Like he divinely belongs on the throne.
So you have to be very careful how you tell someone like Nebuchadnezzar something bad is happening. That's why Nebuchadnezzar had to forget the dream altogether. Uh-huh. Because if he remembered the dream.
Would have killed everyone around him.
But he would have killed anyone who gives him a bad interpretation. But when Daniel told him the dream, and he said, that's exactly what I remember, he's ready to hear whatever he has to say about it. Right? We're going to learn the dream next week and the interpretation. But you see, with Paro's dream is just so obvious what it meant. Something weak is coming to overcome something strong. But no Egyptian could tell Paro what that means because. Who can explain why the man who leads, the mightiest king on the planet right now, is dreaming about something weak overcoming something strong? Why would I dream of such a thing? In my mind, the fat cows devour the skinny cows. And you know an amazing thing? What holiday always coincides with the reading of this dream? Hanukkah. Mikates is always on Hanukkah. With a holiday celebrating the defeat of the many and the strong at the hands of the weak. We were reading in the Torah reading, of course the Torah reading much before, reading the Torah reading about a mighty king who was taught this Hebrew lesson from this young Hebrew, Yosef, about the weak overcoming the strong. So Paro is see, Yosef had something good, because Yosef was telling him basically a good dream, a good interpretation, to save your country from this, and he impressed him. God has given you this great gift of prophecy, and your mind was the one that came up with it, no one else's. And you're going to save your nation through my good advice. So Paro is very, he's impressed, and he's flattered with all of this attention, and he starts saying, he says, now, he doesn't say now that your God gave you all this information, he goes, now that God gave this information, it's amazing how Paro starts speaking about God.
Your God, he says.
He didn't say your God. He says, now that God has told you this, he says, there's no one smarter than you. I want you to be the one that sets this up. And so that when Yosef told his brothers, tell father, ki somani Elokim la'adon al kol eretz Mitzrayim. You see a beautiful homily coming out of these words? Somani Elokim la'adon al kol eretz Mitzrayim. Pshat, it means, God made me a master here in Egypt. But it can also homiletically be understood, Somani Elokim la'adon al kol eretz Mitzrayim. I made God to be the master of Egypt. You hear it? I made God the master of Egypt by...
It's a little far-fetched.
Yeah, it's not the pshat, correct?
Yeah, you have to really...
But it means that, but no, but the Egyptian king starts talking about God. Wait till you see what Nebuchadnezzar says after he shows him the dream. All right, but I'm just, I'll put the cat out of the bag. But after he tells him the dream, he raises him to great heights. But you know what happens then? They're jealous. So they bring out some kind of way to destroy Daniel by convincing Nebuchadnezzar that no one should worship anything but his God for 30 days. And then they find out that Daniel is worshiping a different God. So the punishment is you get thrown into the furnace. Right? And they survive the furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar really... so this is going to be an exciting book. So I love narrative here, and this book has a little something for everybody.